You understand nothing. You have already given me too many drugs. My friend Lobia is trying to warn me of something, from deep inside. I need to listen, not plug my ears. Yosa's voice took on a scolding tone. You should never have probed so deeply without companion sisters. Are you forgetting who I am? This is a matter that involves my hidden rank. You will not challenge me. Grabbing a surgical las knife from a tray, she spoke in a menacing tone. If I tell you to plunge this into your own heart, you will do it. The other medical sisters stepped back, not knowing what to make of this. Anirul glared at Yosa, her doe eyes ablaze. If I determine that your continued presence endangers the success of the project, I will kill you myself. Be careful. Very careful. Mohiam, however, glided closer and intervened. Have the voices given you advice, my lady? Can you hear them now? Yes, and they are louder than ever before. With a quick movement, Mohiam pushed the endangered medical sister beyond the reach of the agitated woman. Lady Anirul, it is your right and duty to shepherd this special birth, but you must not interfere with these women. Still holding the las knife, her body twitching as if she were fighting other memory for control of her mind and muscles, Anirul took a seat on a suspensor chair beside Jessica. The other two medical sisters stood off to one side, but at a hand signal from Mohiam, they resumed their work. Amidst this chaos, Jessica took calming breaths and cycled through techniques that Mohiam had taught her. Anirul tried to quell her raging anxiety so that her dangerous emotions would not contaminate the birthing room. Feral thoughts raced through the Kwisatz mother's troubled mind, struggling to be heard over the internal and external disorder. She bit the knuckles of one hand. If anything went wrong in the next few hours, the Kwisatz Haderach program could be set back for centuries, and possibly ruined for all time. It must not happen. Anirul suddenly looked down at the las knife in surprise, then set it on a nearby table, but still within reach. I am sorry, child, I did not mean to upset you, she murmured. Presently she continued in a prayer-like tone. At this most important time, you must use Pranabindu skills to guide the baby through your birth canal. She looked at the shining implement on the table. I will cut your daughter's umbilical cord myself. I am ready to begin, Jessica announced. I will intensify my labor now. How they will hate me when they see. She exercised precise Bene Gesserit control over her body, over every birthing muscle, and exerted pressure. What would Lady Anirul do? Her eyes bore the signs of madness, but was the Emperor's wife capable of murder? Jessica vowed to remain alert and ready to protect Leto's son in any way possible. The Emperor still speaks by the authority of the people and their elected Landsrad. But the Great Council is becoming more and more a subordinate power, and the people are fast turning into an uprooted proletariat, a mob to be aroused and wielded by demagogues. We are in the process of transforming into a military empire. Premier Ein Kalamar of Richiz, speech to the Landsrad. A swift and impressive display of force. Shaddam was quite pleased with the effect. Arrakis and the Imperium would never be the same again. Unannounced and unexpected, an armada of guild ships appeared in the skies over the desert world. Five highliners, each more than 20 kilometers long, took their places in orbit, within sight of the Harkonnen capital of Carthage. An astonished Baron Harkonnen stood on the residency's shielded balcony and stared up into the night sky. A borealis display of ionization discharges rippled overhead in patterns that made his corpulent flesh crawl. "Damnation! What is going on up there?" Buoyed by his suspensor belt, the Baron held himself steady to keep from drifting. Deep in his gut, he regretted that he had not returned to Giddy Prime, as he'd intended, the week before. A hot breeze crept like a plague through the dark streets. High above him, the bright, reflected shapes of highliners spread out in low orbit, like jewels floating on a black sea. The Carthag city guard sounded alarms, rousing troops from the barracks and locking down the populace under a state of martial law. An aide rushed in, even more afraid of the spectacle in the sky than of his Harkonnen master. "My Lord Baron, a guild envoy has sent a message from the Highliners. He wishes to speak to you." Indignantly, the fat man puffed out his cheeks. "I am most curious to know what in the hells they think they are doing above my planet." Melange production had exceeded the Emperor's expectations, even despite the amount of spice he surreptitiously skimmed. House Harkonnen should have nothing to fear, even with Shaddam's recent incomprehensible petulance and volatility. "There must be some mistake." The aide switched on a comm screen and adjusted controls until he made the proper connection. Harsh words grated across the speaking mesh. "Baron Vladimir Harkonnen, your crimes have been exposed. The Guild and the Emperor will decide your punishment. You are subject to our combined judgment." The Baron was accustomed to denying his culpability in criminal matters, but in this instance he was so astounded that he could not even stammer an excuse.
But I don't know what..."
"This is not a dialogue," the voice said, louder and harsher. "This is a pronouncement. Shoham auditors and guild representatives are being sent down to scrutinize every aspect of your spice operations." The Baron could barely draw a breath.
"Why? I demand to know what I am accused of doing."
"Your secrets will be exposed and your mistakes punished. Until we decree otherwise, the flow of spice throughout the Imperium will be cut off. You, Baron Harkonnen, must provide the answers we seek." Panic set in. He had no idea what had triggered this absurd saber-rattling.
Who are my accusers? What is the evidence?"
"The Guild will now cut off your communications and shut down all spaceports on Arrakis. Effective immediately, we are suspending the operation of spice harvesters in the field. All thopters are grounded." The comm system in front of him began to smoke and spark. "This message is ended." From overhead, the armada of guild ships broadcast intense pulses that disabled the circuitry and navigational systems on all vessels in the Carthag spaceport. Inside the Baron's residency, glow globes dimmed and then brightened as they were bombarded. Some fizzled and exploded, showering plas fragments on his head. He covered his face and shouted into the comm system, but there was no response. Even local comm links had broken down. In blind rage, he bellowed, though no one except those in his immediate presence could hear, and they wisely fled. The Baron could not demand any further explanation or summon help from anyone. The underbellies of three Highliners opened, and the main Sardaukar fleet detached from their docking clamps. Battlecruisers, corvettes, marauders, bombers, every military vessel the Emperor could gather on short notice. In mounting this operation, Shaddam understood that he was leaving other parts of his Imperium vulnerable. But he had too much to gain, in one unexpected masterstroke. Not even the Guild understood his true aims. Wearing a dress uniform emblazoned with Commander-in-Chief insignia, The Emperor sat on the bridge as his flagship descended toward Arrakis. This would be the culmination of decades of planning, an unexpectedly quick finish to the overall Amal project. For once, he would lead his troops into victory himself, for the magnificent end of the Great Spice War. His Project Amal was ready, and now he would remove Arrakis from the equation. The Sardaukar had been instructed to follow his direct orders, though Supreme Bashar Garon would supervise the actual maneuvers. Shaddam needed someone he could trust to act without question, because there would be many questions. Standing stiffly beside him, the weathered Sardaukar veteran did not know the Emperor's plan or understand the desired outcome of this confrontation. But he would follow his superior's command, as always. Using the Holocaust weapons they had demonstrated on Zanovar, the Sardaukar warships were about to eliminate all spice on Arrakis, a necessary step in the shaping of Shaddam's new Imperium. Afterward, he would have the only remaining answer, Amal. With this one attack, Shaddam Carino IV would strengthen the Golden Lion throne and crush the monopolies and trading conglomerates that had hobbled his rule. Ah, if only Hasimir could be here to see my victory. The Emperor reminded himself how he had proven time and again that he didn't need an advisor pestering him, contradicting his ideas, constantly trying to take credit. As his flagship flew closer to the fringe of atmosphere, the Emperor leaned forward in his command chair to stare at the cracked brown planet. Ugly place. Would further devastation even be noticeable here? He saw an incomplete ring of satellites, ineffective weather observers that the Guild had grudgingly put into orbit after years of insistence from the Baron himself. They monitored only Harkonnen-controlled areas, while providing no information at all about the deep desert and polar regions. "Time for target practice," he announced. "Send out your marauders and destroy those satellites, every one." He tapped his fingers on the padded arm of the command chair. He had always loved playing soldier. "Let us blind the Baron even further." "Yes, Your Imperial Majesty," said Zum Garon. Moments later, small attack ships swarmed from the highliners and spread out like hordes of locusts. With precise shots, they vaporized one satellite after another. Shaddam savored each tiny explosion. From the ground, his fleet must look terrifying. The Guild assumed he only meant to establish a firm military presence here, to soften up any Harkonnen defenders so that the Sardaukar could confiscate illegal Milan stockpiles. Already, Lansrad nobles, those few who knew he had brought a fleet here, were calling in favors, shifting positions, trying to become the next recipient of the Arrakis fief and its spice industry. A soon-to-be worthless spice industry. Oh, how Shaddam looked forward to the next act in his grand play. He thought back on the dry and outdated drama, My Father's Shadow, which had extolled the virtues of Crown Prince Raphael Corino, a deluded fool who had never formally accepted the imperial throne. Shaddam had considered becoming a patron of the arts himself, though his accomplishments could not be limited to cultural ones. An imperial biographer would document his military and economic victories, and a team of writers would create enduring literary works to enthrall later generations with his greatness. It was all so simple, once an emperor received the absolute power he deserved. After the desert planet was no more than a charred ball, the Spacing Guild, and everyone else who relied upon Melange, would be wrapped around his finger. He decided to call this campaign the Arrakis Gambit. For such a fabulous triumph, it was worth taking extravagant risks. Greatness must always be combined with vulnerability. Crown Prince Rafael Corino. Ready to face another turning point in his life, Duke Leto marched into the Landsrad Hall of Oratory. Even with the Emperor off on some war game, Leto was prepared to deliver what might well be the most important speech of his noble career. He recalled the last time he had appeared before this august assembly. He had been very young, the newly installed Duke of House Atreides, following the untimely death of his father. After the overthrow of Ix by the Tlelaxu, Leto had been brash, decrying the invaders and condemning the Landsrad for ignoring the pleas of Earl Vernius. Instead of being impressed, the representatives had laughed at the immature young nobleman, much as they had scoffed at the protestations of Ambassador Pilru for so many years. But this afternoon, as Duke Leto led his proud procession down the entrance promenade, delegates cheered and shouted his name. Applause swelled in the vast hall, making him feel stronger, more sure of himself. Though they had no means of communicating with one another now, the disparate parts of his overall plan had to proceed with perfect timing. Already, Thufir Hawat had made his successful move against the blockade at Beakal, and the separate attack would proceed on Ix, even without confirmation from the two infiltrators. Leto knew his own role here on Kaitane. If the scheme went as planned, if Romber and Gurney were still alive, the liberation of Ix would be complete, and the new Earl Vernius would be secure in his ancestral home before anyone could object. But only if everything happened at once. Immediately before entering the Hall of Oratory, Leto received a rushed notification from one of the nameless Bene Gesserit sisters, who fluttered like ravens around the imperial court. "Your concubine Jessica has gone into labor. She is being cared for by the best medical sisters. There is nothing to fear." The acolyte gave him a small smile, along with a reflexive bow, as she backed away. "Lady Anirul thought you might wish to know." Feeling unsettled, Leto strode toward the speaking platform. Jessica was about to have his child. He should be with her in the birthing room. The Bene Gesserit might not approve of a man's presence there, yet under other circumstances, without all these pressing affairs of state, he would have defied them. But this was a matter of protocol. His speech had to be given now, while Duncan Idaho led the troops into the caverns of Ix. As the court crier read his name and titles, Leto tapped his fingers on the lectern and waited for the cheers to die down. Finally, a silence of expectation blanketed the chamber, as if the delegates suspected he might have something interesting, and even bold, to say. His popularity and stature in the Landsrad had been building for years. No other nobleman, including those much wealthier than he, would have risked such an impetuous and unexpected move. "You all know the plight of Beakal, ravaged by a botanical plague that threatens to destroy its ecosystem. Although I had my own dispute with the Prime Magistrate, that matter has been settled to my satisfaction. My heart, like yours, aches for the suffering Beakali people. Therefore, I have dispatched ships filled with relief supplies, in hopes that Emperor Shaddam will allow us to pass the blockade and deliver vital aid." Applause rippled through the hall, reflecting admiration mixed with surprise. "But that is only one small part of my activities. More than 20 years ago, I appeared before you to protest the illegal Tlelaxu conquest of Ix, the proper fief of House Vernius, friend to House Atreides, and friend to many of you. Receiving no help from the Emperor, Earl Dominic Vernius chose to go renegade. He and his wife were hunted down while the vile Tlelaxu invaders secured their hold on Ix. Since that time, Prince Romber, the rightful heir, has lived under my protection on Caladan. For years, the Ixian ambassador in exile has implored you for help.
but not one of you lifted a finger in assistance.
He waited, watched, and listened to the uncomfortable stirring in the cavernous hall. Today I have taken unilateral action to correct that injustice. He let the ominous statement sink in with his listeners, then continued in a resounding voice,
"Even now, as I speak to you, Atreides' military forces are attacking Ix, with the intention of restoring Prince Romber Vernius to his proper place. Our aim is to drive out the Tleilaxu and liberate the Ixian people."
A gasp rippled through the throng, followed by anxious, murmurous conversation. None of them had expected this. He forced a brave smile and changed his approach.
"Under oppressive and inept Tleilaxu rule, the production of essential Ixian technology has drastically decreased. The Landsrad, Choam, and the Spacing Guild all know this. The Imperium needs good Ixian machines. Every nobleman here will benefit from the restoration of House Vernius. Let no one deny it."
He looked around the sea of faces, daring anyone to disagree.
"I came to Kaitain to speak with the Padishah Emperor, but he is preoccupied with another military matter."
Leto saw mostly blank faces and shrugs, but a few nods from those who seemed to know something.
"I have no doubt that my dear cousin Shaddam will support the restoration of House Vernius to its former position in the Imperium. As Duke Atreides, I have taken action for justice, for the Imperium, and for my friend, the Prince of Ix."
As Leto concluded, waves of reaction passed through the Landsrad Hall. He heard cheers, a few angry shouts, and above all, confusion. Finally, the tide turned. One by one, delegates rose and began to applaud. Within moments, the hall erupted in a standing ovation. Waving and nodding to them in appreciation, Leto paused as he caught the gaze of a dignified, gray-haired man in the audience who had no impressive uniform or rank, no box or reserved seat. Ambassador Kamar Pilru. The Ixian representative looked up at Leto with something like reverence, and he began to weep. The expectation of danger leads to preparation. Only those who are prepared can expect to survive. Swordmaster Jewel Naret, Archives. It was a long journey back to Caladan. The Highliner threaded its way along a route in the Imperium, stopping at planet after planet. Among other vessels, the Highliner's cargo bay held the small Atreides relief flotilla, with Thufir Hawat aboard the flagship. After completing his diversionary humanitarian mission to Beakal, Thufir wanted to be back home in the gray stone towers of Castle Caladan, high on a cliff overlooking the sea. His feint against the Sardaukar blockade had been as successful as he could have hoped. He had ruffled the Emperor's feathers and also delivered the relief supplies. After Shaddam had summoned his commander away, the Atreides flotilla had waited near Beakal for 9 days until another Highliner arrived to take them on the scheduled route to Caladan. First out of the hold, a handful of Atreides ships dropped into the cloudy skies of Caladan and were quickly swallowed up in the swirling weather patterns that covered the ocean. Behind the small flotilla, merchant vessels and passenger frigates descended to the spaceport on their regular business runs. Thufir felt as if he could sleep for 3 days straight. He had not rested well on this trip, because of all he had needed to accomplish, and because of his concerns about Duncan's primary assault on Ix. It should be happening at this very moment. But he would not take that much-needed rest. Not yet. With the Duke away on Kaitain, and most of the Atreides military forces dispatched to Ix,
He wanted to make absolutely certain that the remaining military personnel and equipment were set up properly for the defense of the planet.
Caladan was too vulnerable.
When his few escort ships settled down at the military base adjacent to the Kala Municipal Spaceport, the Mentat was astounded to find no vessels at all. Only a few elderly men and women in uniforms, little more than a maintenance staff. A reserve lieutenant told him that Duke Leto had decided to throw everything into the fight for Ix. Seeing this, Thufir had an uncertain, exposed feeling. As the Highliner cruised in parking orbit, more ships dropped out in the continuing bustle of space commerce. Later that day, when the immense guild vessel crossed over the sparsely populated eastern continent, a large group of unmarked craft disembarked at the last moment, taking high orbital positions, far from prying eyes. Even with a pilot as skilled as Hi-Iresser, the wings of the scout ship thumped and bounced as it cut through the cold storm currents of Caladan's upper atmosphere. The red-headed swordmaster sat behind the controls of a rapid reconnaissance ship, sent from the hastily gathered Grumman Harkonnen fleet. Resser peered down through patchy gaps in the clouds as he soared away from the planet's nightside, racing the sunset and gaining upon the daylight that lingered over the water. His lord, Viscount Moritani, was willing to sacrifice everything in a sudden attack. Glossu Rabban, though a brute himself, was more conservative, wanting to know where the force would make its surprise attack and what their chances of success were. Though Resser had sworn his loyalty to the Viscount, after many rigorous oaths and testings, he preferred Rabban's point of view. Resser frequently disagreed with his lord in principle, but after years of swordmaster training, he knew his place. His loyalty could not be questioned. He clung to his honor. As did Duncan Idaho. Resser remembered the years that he and Duncan had spent on island-dotted Ginaz. They had been fast friends from the beginning, and had ultimately fought their way to victory, becoming swordmasters themselves. When other students from Grumman had been cast out of Ginaz because of a black dishonor committed by the Viscount, Resser had stayed behind, the only one from his house to complete the training. After graduating and returning to Grumman, he had assumed he would be disgraced and perhaps even executed. Duncan had implored Resser to come to Caladan, to join House Atreides, but the redhead had refused. Bravely, he had gone home anyway. He had kept his honor and survived. Because of his fighting and leadership skills, Resser had risen rapidly through the Grumman ranks, attaining the position of Special Forces Commander. For this mission to Caladan, he was second in command only to the Viscount himself. But he preferred to work hands-on. Resser flew the scout ship himself, and when it came time to fight, he would be in the thick of it. He didn't look forward to opposing Duncan Idaho, but had no choice. Politics made razor cuts through relationships. Now, as he remembered all the things young Duncan had told him about his beloved and beautiful Caladan, Resser plunged beneath a raft of gray clouds until he could see the landscape, the cities, and the weaknesses of the planet. He flew in, racing quickly over Kala City, across the river deltas and the lowlands filled with Pundi rice farms. He noted the murky swamp of kelp beds out in the shallow waters, and the black molars of reefs surrounded by white breakwaters. Resser recognized what he saw. Duncan had told him everything. As they had sat together reading letters from home, Duncan had shared delicacies sent to him from House Atreides. He had talked about what a good man the old Duke had been, how Paulus had taken Duncan under his wing as a boy and raised him in the castle, where the newcomer had proven his loyalty. Resser heaved a deep sigh and flew on. The scout ship flew fast and low,
while the redhead drank in the details with his trained eyes. He saw what he needed to, then flew back to the hidden fleet to make his report, unable to reach any other conclusion. Later, when he stood at attention in front of the Viscount, he announced, "They have left themselves completely vulnerable, my lord. Caladan will be an easy conquest." Alone and concerned, Thufir Hawat stood by the new statues that Leto had erected on the rocky promontory. Towering figures of old Pallas and young Victor Atreides, holding aloft the brazier of an eternal flame. Out on the calm water, many little boats puttered about, sifting through the kelp, dragging nets, and hunting larger fish. It seemed peaceful. The clouds were patchy as the sun lowered toward the horizon. The warrior Mentat also saw a single ship flying high and fast. Obviously a reconnaissance craft, a scout. Unmarked. Detailed projections, first and second order. Thufir predicted what might be occurring. Knew he could do little to defend Caladan against an outright attack. He still had a few warships from the escort flotilla, but nothing else remained of the Atreides' home defense. Leto had gambled everything on his Ixion campaign. Too much, perhaps. The unmarked scout ship streaked overhead, gathering all of the damning information a spy would need. Looking up at the stony visage of Duke Pallas, and then down at the innocent face of Victor, the Mentat of House Atreides was reminded of his past mistakes. "I dare not fail you again, my Duke," he said aloud to the Colossus. "Nor can I let Leto down. But I wish I had some answer, some way to protect this beautiful world." Thufir gazed across the ocean, saw the ragtag fleet of fishing boats scattered at random across the waters. This conundrum would require all of his Mentat skill to solve, and he hoped that would be enough. "They have hindered and hunted me for the last time with their village Provo mines. Here I make my stand." Attributed to the renegade Earl Dominic Vernius. Shortly after noon, precisely on time, alarms rang out in the underground city. It was a joyous sound for Prince Romber Vernius. "It's starting. Duncan is here." In the shadows of a suboid warren, the Ixion heir looked over at Gurney Halleck, whose glass splinter eyes shone in his lumpy face. "We gird our loins, sing our songs, and shed blood in the name of the Lord." He smiled and began to move. "No time to lose." Kater Pilru, haggard and red-eyed, leaped to his feet. He hadn't slept in days, and seemed to live more on adrenaline than nourishment. His planted explosives would have just gone off at the port of entry canyon, opening the way for Atreides' troops to force their way inside. Kater called, "It is time to break out the weaponry and rally anyone who will follow us. The people are ready to fight back at last." His drawn face had the angelic, ethereal look of a man who had transcended the need for fear or reassurance. "We follow you into battle, Prince Romber." Gurney's ink-vine scar flickered as he scowled. "Take care, Romber. Don't give our enemies too easy a target. You would be a big prize for them." The cyborg prince strode toward a low doorway. "I will not hide while others fight my battles, Gurney. At least wait until we secure part of the city. I will announce my return from the steps of the Grand Palais." Romber's tone invited no discussion. "I won't be satisfied with anything else." Gurney grumbled, but fell silent, considering how best to protect this proud, stubborn man. Kater led the way to a concealed armory, a small ventilation equipment room that they had converted to their own purposes. Romber and Gurney had already distributed components broken down from the sophisticated Atreides combat pod. They had smuggled weaponry, explosives, shields, and communications devices into the hands of zealous rebel volunteers. Kater grabbed the first weapons he could lay his hands on, two grenades and a stun club. Romber attached a rack of throwing knives to his belt, then hefted a heavy two-handed sword with one of his powerful cyborg arms. Gurney selected a dueling dagger and a long sword. All three strapped on body shields and activated them, producing the familiar, comfortable hum. Ready. They left the las guns untouched. At close quarters, with shields activated, they didn't want to risk setting off a deadly lasgun shield interaction, which could vaporize the underground city. While alarms continued to sound, some of the Tleilaxu production facility doors closed in an automatic lockdown. Others jammed in their tracks. Rumors in the past few days had already alerted the Ixians to what might happen. But many of them still could not believe that the arrival of Atreides' saviors was at hand. Now they were overjoyed. Kater bellowed for support and ran through the tunnels. "Forward, citizens! To the Grand Palais!" Many of the workers were afraid. Some felt a cautious hope. Subway labor crews ran about in confusion, and Kater shouted until they took up the chant. "For House Vernius! For House Vernius!" He hurled his first grenade into a knot of screaming Tleilaxu factory administrators. It exploded in the cavern with a thunderous boom. Then he used his stun club to thrash any of the gray-skinned men in his way. As Romber charged forward like a rail car, a flechette dart whizzed close to his head, but it was deflected by his shield. Spotting a Tleilaxu master crouching off to one side, the prince hit him in the chest with a thrown knife, then sliced another invader with his heavy sword. He pushed onward, into the melee. Shouting, Romber rallied whatever rebels he could find. From the tunnel opening, he and Gurney handed weapons to eager fighters and directed them to fresh stashes of supplies. "Now is our chance to purge Ix of these invaders forever!" Fighting his way to the center of the cavern floor, Gurney bellowed commands, worrying that these poorly organized revolutionaries would be cut to ribbons by the professional Sardaukar. The hollow sky flickered on the grotto ceiling as explosions ripped through control substations in the stalactite buildings. The most magnificent structure, the inverted cathedral of the Grand Palais, hung like a holy grail for Romber to obtain. In the upper levels, the uniformed Atreides troops rushed across high walkways behind a dark-haired swordmaster, with blades raised. "There's Duncan." Gurney gestured toward the walkway overhead. "We need to get up there." Romber fixed his gaze on the Grand Palais. "Let's go." Following Kater, shouting and attacking ferociously, the improvised band swelled with volunteers as they surged across the cavern floor. The rebels commandeered an empty cargo barge, a heavy anti-grav platform designed for ferrying off-world materials through the Port of Entry Canyon and down to lower construction facilities. Gurney climbed onto the barge's control deck and turned on the suspensor engines. They made a high-pitched whine. "Aboard! Aboard!" Fighters scrambled onto the barge platform, some unarmed but willing to fight with their fingernails if necessary. When the vehicle began to rise in the air, a few rebels were crowded off the edge and tumbled to the floor. Others jumped up to grab handrails, dangling until comrades hauled them onto the deck. The barge lifted while Sardaukar swarmed about below it, trying to form into regiments. A spray of flechette needles erupted from their sidearms, ricocheting off walls, striking bystanders. Body shields slowed or deflected some of the projectiles, but most of the innocent citizens were unprotected. From their high vantage on the cargo barge, the wild rebels opened fire upon their enemies below. Unlike the Emperor's soldiers, the Tleilaxu masters wore no body shields. Kater, in a frenzy, found a projectile weapon and fired it. As the barge floated higher on its suspensors, Imperial soldiers directed their weapons upward, not even knowing who had taken the vessel. The Sardaukar seemed to be blood-maddened. One of the suspensor engines blew out, causing the platform to tilt. Four hapless rebels slipped and tumbled to their deaths on the stone floor far below. Gurney wrestled with the reluctant controls, but Romber nudged him aside and added power to the remaining engines. The skewed barge rose toward the plaz-walled balconies of the former Grand Palais. The prince stared upward, saw places from his youth, remembered how his family had celebrated their privileged lives. He wrenched the guidance controls, and the overloaded platform diverted one of the broad windows, a balcony and observation deck, where celebrations had once been held for the wedding anniversary of Dominic Vernius and his beautiful lady Shando. Romber drove the barge straight through the window, like a stake into a demon's heart, smashing the ornate balcony. Shards and other debris fell around them, and screams mixed with defiant cheers. The barge's suspensor engines faded as Romber shut down power, and the sluggish craft ground to a halt. Kater was the first to leap onto the checkerboard floor into the midst of panicky Tleilaxu and a handful of Sardaukar guards who scrambled to defend themselves. "Victory on Ix!" The freedom fighters took up the cry and surged forward with more enthusiasm than weaponry. Accompanied by Gurney Halleck, Romber stepped off the barge for his triumphal return to the Grand Palais. Standing in the debris-strewn hall, surrounded by battle cries and gunfire, he felt as if he had finally come home. Within the ceiling levels, Duncan Idaho led Atreides' troops into the brunt of the clash, and the elite Sardaukar responded savagely. The Imperial soldiers crammed what seemed to be melange wafers into their mouths, an overdose of spice, and raced into the fray. Like animals gone berserk, the Sardaukar hurled themselves into hopeless offensives against overwhelming odds. At close quarters, shields crackling, they discarded their long-range weapons and charged into the Atreides force, using well-timed knives, swords, and even bare hands to penetrate defensive shields. Each time the Sardaukar subdued one of Duke Leto's fighters, they disabled his shield and ripped him apart in an instant. Commander Kando Garon, his uniform torn and bloodied, waded in against Duncan's troops. Though a long sword hung at his hip, Garon declined to use it. Instead, he wielded a more personal kindjal, jabbing back and forth with the wicked dagger tip. He pierced eyes, severed jugular veins, and simply ignored the Atreides' assaults around him. A brash Caladan lieutenant slipped in from the side, dipped the point of his sword through the commander's shield, and stabbed it into the meat of Garon's shoulder. The Sardaukar commander stopped in his tracks, shook his head as if to clear the gnats of pain from his spice frenzy, and plunged back into the melee with an even greater ferocity, oblivious to his attacker. Wailing with bestial voices, the Sardaukar soldiers rushed forward, a tidal wave of uniforms in no formation whatsoever.